This is Marketplace After the Bell. I'm Scott Jagow, and I'm here to make sense of what happened this week in business and the economy. It's Friday, July 10th. This week, a math degree might have come in handy. My head, at least, was spinning with numbers. There was this debate about a second stimulus package, which would actually be the third stimulus package in about 18 months. GM split in two, old and new, and the company certainly has to be on its ninth life. By most accounts, GM only has one more chance to get it right. The G8 pledged to keep the Earth's temperature from rising 2 degrees Celsius by 2050, but some say the plan and the numbers add up to economic pain. The number on healthcare reform is staggering. Let's just say it has 12 zeros in it, and the debate this week focused on where $1 trillion or more would come from. This week's retail numbers were pretty awful, and that tells us something. In fact, numbers do tell a story. They can show us what's happening in the economy. Sometimes, if you add everything up, you get a clearer picture. And sometimes, like maybe this week, the numbers just give you a headache.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
Marketplace, providing you what you need to know about business and economics on air and online. Explore everything Marketplace has to offer, from explainers on technical terms to stories on personal finance at marketplace.org.
I can't tell you how many editorials I read this week for or against a second stimulus package, including one that pointed out this would actually be the third stimulus package. I know it's easy to forget President Bush's $600 checks last year, especially if you didn't get one, but it was supposed to be stimulus. Anyway, the question most people are asking is, why do we need another stimulus bill when the one passed earlier this year has barely trickled out into the economy? Reporter Steve Henn asked economist James Galbraith what's gone wrong.
Difficulty here is that it's not quite big enough, not quite soon enough.
Even shovel-ready projects take months to get started. And Dean Baker at the Center for Economic Policy Research says infrastructure projects are not enough. He'd like Congress to offer direct aid to state and local governments.
So they don't have to make the cutbacks that so many state and local governments are making now. That's going to make the recession much worse.
But these economic concerns are running headlong into an unpleasant political reality on Capitol Hill.
At the moment, there is no appetite for another stimulus package.
Norm Ornstein follows Congress at the American Enterprise Institute.
You've got an awful lot of fiscally conservative Democrats who have grown increasingly uneasy about the hole we have dug.
Senior Democratic aides in the House say for the moment there are no plans for a new stimulus bill. Instead, they're focusing on getting money from the last bill out the door faster.
France even gave the U.S. a jab this week about stimulus. The minister in charge of the French stimulus package said by the time Washington gets around to doling out its money, the crisis could be over. General Motors came out of bankruptcy today. The new GM, that is. There's still a separate company in Chapter 11, the rotting carcass, if you will. All of those assets will be sold off. But the new company doesn't have to worry about any of that. It only has to worry about cars, customers, and culture. That's how CEO Fritz Henderson put it at today's press conference. Henderson said all the things you'd expect to hear. We're focused. We're leaner. Business as usual is over at GM. But he was asked, why should people believe that?
Your point is you can't teach an old dog new tricks is true. I also have pointed out to my management team Einstein's definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. We know we have to change. Today is about the beginning of that change. And, it's our job to prove to you and to everybody that we can get that job done.
So what are the odds that GM can get the job done? Alisa Roth looked into that.
Michael Robinette follows the global market for auto consultant CSM Worldwide. He says the new GM can't bank too much on its gloried past.
Chevrolet, as we may have known it back in the 50s or 60s, will have to stay there.
Instead, he says, the company needs to move past its history to create something new that people actually want to buy. That'll most likely mean smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. It'll definitely mean fewer of them. Alan Baum is an auto consultant in Michigan. He says to see the future, take a look across the Atlantic.
If you look at the European market, you see a market that is essentially very competitive with a lot of players, none of which have dominant shares.
GM sells well in China, so it's already realized that it has to compete globally and not just in the U.S. Baum says now it has to figure out what companies like Toyota have been doing for a long time, build a kind of transnational vehicle at a reasonable price. John Quelch studies marketing at Harvard. He says GM can't rely on waving the American flag to sell cars anymore.
There are relatively fewer and fewer consumers who are willing to pay a premium or suffer a deficit in product quality in order to be patriotic and buy American.
But here's a glimmer of hope. Chrysler got out of bankruptcy before GM, and already Chrysler's numbers are showing positive signs. Jeremy Hobson has more.
Thank the government's auto task force. Thank Fiat. Jesse Toprak at Edmunds.com says it doesn't matter who you thank. Just under a month after emerging from bankruptcy, Chrysler is moving faster than many thought possible.
I think that they've emerged with minimal damage. And we've also, interestingly, seen that the idea that people will not buy from a bankrupt company is simply not accurate. We've actually seen that bankruptcy was probably one of the best promotions Chrysler could have come up with. In fact, their sales went up.
Those sales and a complete factory shutdown means dealerships are running out of cars. Joe Philippi says that's one reason factories are reopening so soon. He's president of Auto Trends Consulting.
Dealers are running out of inventory of certain products that are doing well in the marketplace.
Analysts say keeping sales up during the reorganization is going to be key. Chrysler needs the cash to keep the engine running until it can start selling Fiat's cars in the United States.
The car market is still very weak, for obvious reasons. And the overall retail numbers that came out this week told a similar story. Things just aren't turning around. Compared to last year, Abercrombie & Fitch sales were down 32%. Target down 6%. Costco, JCPenney's, Saks, on and on, the sales numbers were lower. So where are the green shoots of retail? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looked into that.
After living through more than a year of recession, you'd think retailers would have figured this out by now. Consumers are freaked out, they're spending less, saving more, and many won't buy anything unless it's a steal. In fact, we've been reporting for months that retailers are adapting, closing stores, cutting way back on inventory so they won't be stuck with piles of unsold merchandise. Analyst Sarah Johnson at IHS Global Insight says the chains have been making changes, but it's not enough.
Retailers are indeed cutting inventories, but until demand picks up, they will need to continue price discounting. Consumers won't spend unless they feel they're getting a good price.
Johnson says getting people to spend more is going to take a while.
We're still seeing very steep job cuts, and the impact of the stimulus programs is beginning, but it's not encouraging spending.
Casey Grust is with the Retail Industry Leaders Association.
Last year, we had government stimulus spending checks that had just been released.
Those checks boosted shopping, which makes this year's numbers look even worse by comparison.
The numbers do tell a story, but it isn't one most people want to hear. I thought it was interesting what commentator Robert Reich said this week. He said this economy will never recover. It can't go back to what it was because it was unsustainable in the first place. So his question is, how and when does the new economy begin?
I take one, one, one because you left me, and two, two, two for my family, and three, three, three for my heartache, and four, four, four for my headaches, and five, five, five for my lonely, and six, six, six for my sorrow, and seven, seven for no tomorrow, and eight, eight, I forget what eight was for, but nine, nine, nine for lost God, ten, ten.
This is Marketplace After the Bell. I'm Scott Jagow. I'll tell you what 8 is for. 8 countries. 8 world leaders. The G8 met this week, and there were high hopes that the group would make some headway on climate change. Okay, medium-sized hopes from various groups. Stephen Beard was on the story.
They believe that the US, Europe, Japan, and the fast-growing economies like China and India were all going to agree to deep cuts in their carbon emissions, an overall 50% reduction by the middle of this century, with the rich countries cutting by 80%. but it seems those numbers will be missing from tomorrow's communique. Mark Nichols is editor of Environmental Finance magazine. He says the big emerging economies have balked.
I think there's skepticism amongst the Chinese and the Indians that the West will deliver on nearer-term emissions targets and will provide financing again in the near term to developing countries to help them adapt to the effects of climate change.
He says the developing world harbours a deep resentment towards the rich countries over this issue.
The West has enjoyed industrialisation based on fossil fuels. China and India don't see why they should be denied that growth.
And that's where climate change and the economy intersect. Even though the G8 reached no agreement on emissions targets, there was a general statement that global temperatures must not rise more than 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. Obviously, there will have to be more to the plan than just that. One question we had was, what does the G8's failure this week mean for the climate change bill moving through Congress? Kai Rizdahl talked to our sustainability reporter Sarah Gardner about it.
We really don't know. Phil Radford, who's head of Greenpeace USA, told me today he thinks the chances now are about 50-50 that we'll get a bill by the end of the year. Others are more optimistic. The problem is a lot of people say it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. You've got China and India on the one hand who want to see more serious commitments by the U.S. in greenhouse gas reductions in the near term. And they want more aid from the U.S. in achieving their own reductions. But the U.S. really can't or isn't willing to say what it can do before they see what the Senate will pass. So really, it's all just very bad timing.
Right. You go first. No, you go first. Right?
That's right.
Pan this forward for me for a little bit to the big climate change conference in Copenhagen in December. There's this conference, the G8, our domestic political situation, and then Copenhagen in December.
Yes. The United Nations Climate Change Conference is a huge opportunity, of course, for the world to make serious commitments to greenhouse gas reductions. Climatologists would say it's the last chance. And many think this G8 meeting in Italy this week is crucial to Copenhagen's success. Now, having said that, there are other people who say, wait, don't panic. We have time. Things can change. This is sort of a pre-negotiation to that meeting. Why would all sides be putting their cards on the table right now? Here's William Klein at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
I don't think the G8 was expected to be the location for a massive deal on climate, so I don't see this as devastating.
As you know, President Obama has two top priorities. One of them is climate change. The other is health care. As I said earlier, the debate this week in health care focused on where the money will come from to pay for a bill that might cost 13 figures. More from Steve Henn.
Right now, the debate over health care reform is basically just a numbers game.
I think the bill will certainly cost a trillion or more.
John Hallahan is at the Urban Institute.
So it's going to have to be paid for through some combination of savings from cutbacks to providers, and the rest is going to have to come out of new revenues.
So Hallahan says the administration's been leaning on drug companies and hospitals to cut the fees they charge to the federal government for Medicare, Medicaid, and prescription drugs. A couple weeks ago, drug makers promised to slice $80 billion off the government's health care tab over 10 years. Tomorrow, three large hospital associations are expected to announce they'll cut fees by $155 billion in the next decade. Rick Curtis runs the Institute for Health Policy Solutions.
$100 billion here and $100 billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money.
But will these savings materialize? Chuck Grassley, the top Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, is not convinced.
It doesn't mean anything until we get the Congressional Budget Office to give it a score.
Grassley says when it comes to tallying possible savings in any new law, the CBO is the ultimate scorekeeper. And he's not sure these voluntary industry promises will count.
Well, it seems like they should count as long as there's follow through. I say, get it in writing. Throughout the economy, people are keeping score. And I'll give you an example. J.P. Morgan Chase has this new ad campaign called The Way Forward. This week was the 11th in a series of ads. And it tallied up all the people J.P. Morgan has saved from losing their homes. New York reporter Jeremy Hobson asked J.P. Morgan spokesman Tom Kelly about it.
We think it's important to make sure that people know that we're doing what we can to help the economy.
Which people exactly? Maybe the ones in the big white buildings in Washington, says Sanford Bernstein analyst Brad Hintz.
at a time where Congress is determining the regulatory rules, how financial institutions are going to be controlled, it's probably a prudent thing to position your firm as the man in the white hat who's trying to keep middle Americans in their homes.
In the ad, J.P. Morgan claims to have prevented 565,000 foreclosures since 2007. That includes people who were able to stick with the lower rate on their adjustable rate mortgages. Holden Lewis of Bankrate.com says the number sounds plausible, but like all ads, he says, J.P. Morgan's only tells part of the story.
I get a lot of emails from readers who are frustrated because they can't get any help from their mortgage servicer. And I would say of the major servicers, Chase is the one I've had the most complaints about.
But you won't hear many complaints about J.P. Morgan Chase at the Treasury Department. It was one of the first to pay back its TARP money. Still, like all big banks, it's got some work to do softening its image with consumers. And on that front, a full-page ad or 10 can't hurt.
But who's counting? Well, I'd say in this economy, just about everybody.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10. Money can't buy you back the love that you had then.
That's Marketplace After the Bell for this week. I'm Scott Jagow. I'll be back next Friday to make sense of what happened in business and the economy. Talk to you next week.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10. Money can't buy you back the love that you had.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.